The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled The Sage and the Emperor, is the ninth of a 12-part series, From the Fall of Betar to the Completion of the Mishnah. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmas, Reb Raphael B'Reb Moshe Olav HaSholem, Mr. Rudy Stern of blessed memory, and to the merit and honor of Mr. and Mrs. Saul and Clara Kest, and Mr. and Mrs. Arthur and Ann Bennett.
One of the major foundations of Jewish history is the principle described in the Medrash Rabbah, the Bereishis Rabbah, Perek Mem, in chapter 40. Ma'asa Avos Simon Labonim. The story of the patriarchs serves as a prototype and a guidepost for our subsequent history. As the patterns that they set and the lives that they led kept on repeating themselves in our subsequent history. The life of Abraham, Avraham Avinu, is a prime example. Because of a famine, he was forced to go into Egypt. His sojourn in Egypt, the plague in the house of Pharaoh. Pharaoh took his wife, and there was a plague, and as a result, he was forced not only to give up Abraham's wife, but to let him go. And the subsequent journey home, laden with great wealth, which has really in it all the elements of the later, of the sojourn in Egypt, where we came again because of a famine, we were forced to go down to Egypt. This is what we're reading in the Torah these weeks. And eventually, great plagues were visited upon Pharaoh. We left Egypt with great wealth. Abraham's journey served as a model and forerunner of the subsequent events. Our whole experience with the Romans, who according to rabbinic tradition, according to Chazal, are at least partially descended from Esau, from Yaakov's twin brother, is modeled, that relationship, the Jewish-Roman relationship, is modeled after the original relationship of the patriarch Jacob, Yaakov Avinu, with his brother Esau. As that struggle for dominance was really echoed centuries later in the Roman Jewish struggle. Our persecution at the hands of the Romans, the hatred and contempt they showed for us, even before the time of the Roman Catholic Church, is a mere reflection of the feelings that Esau displayed toward his brother Yaakov. But despite the long and bitter relationship between them, there was an instant of genuine love. An instant when Esau, Jacob's brother, Yaakov's brother, truly longed to express his brotherly feelings. That happened at the historic meeting described in Parshas Vayishlach, when the brothers, after an absence of over 20 years, according to the tradition of the Talmud, it's over 30 years, finally embraced and kissed before they parted ways. Over 1,700 years after that original embrace, history repeated itself again with two very distinguished descendants of Yaakov and Esau. One, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the leader of the Jewish community in Israel and the greatest saint and scholar of his time, a descendant of Jacob, of Yaakov. And the other, the Roman Emperor Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, probably the greatest man Rome ever produced. The paths of these two great men crossed in their infancy and blossomed together in their old age. Their embrace, their friendship, and its impact on Jewish history is the subject of tonight's lecture. Now, if all of you have the handouts here. One of the greatest challenges for historians is to discover the underlying trends and forces that govern history and historical change. Many far-sweeping theories have been offered. Perhaps the most famous is the one offered by Karl Marx, based on the so-called class struggle and Hegelian dialectic of the conflict and resolution of opposing forces. For those who aren't familiar with the Hegelian dialectic, there are, for instance, let's say that there are two forces. In modern times, according to Marx, the proletariat, the working class, which he, according to, I guess, Leninist Marxist doctrine, that included not only those, the poor who were the workers in industry, but also the farmers. That's why the communist symbol is the hammer and the sickle. The sickle represents the agricultural worker, the hammer represents the builder, the industrial worker. They represent one force. The other force represents the capitalists, those who own, those who have the great source of capital, the owners of industry, the owners of the great tracts of land, who according to this model of the class struggle, try to use the proletariat to their own ends. So this is the basis of the struggle between them. These are the two forces. There is, of course, the middle class, those that result in the midst of this conflict, the bourgeoisie. In other words, they are not capitalists. They don't have the wealth. They're not the owners of industry. But yet, these middlemen are able to flourish in the midst of this class struggle. They are the ones who were the small business people, the ones who offer goods and services to both classes. And it's this conflict and the resolution of this conflict and the appearance of a middle class, you know, in the midst of this conflict. And as the middle class grows stronger, it itself gets another class that opposes it, you know, a class that perhaps it exploits. And again, it develops. So this constant struggle of exploitation is how he defines history from time immemorial. According to this theory, of course, I mean, history is predictable. And this is what really the sense of every scientific theory, is to produce something which is predictable. There's a beautiful quote from Le Carré's, you know, story, The Spy That Came In From the Cold, you know, where the spy sees this girl and befriends this girl in the library, and he begins to speak. She's a Jewish girl from Chicago, and begins to speak to her, and he asks her what she believes in. And he says she believes in history. He says, "Oh, you're a communist." That's the belief in history, in the sense that it's of a scientific predictable model, is the belief of the communists. Of course, this is only one of many different schools of thought. There's one school of thought that claim that change occurs not by predictable forces and trends, but rather by great and courageous people who by their genius and personality have altered the course of history. We can give just a few prime examples. Historians claim that one of the great and crucial battles of history was the Battle of Marathon, where the forces of the Persians were successfully thwarted. The Persians under Darius. The one who led the Athenians against them, as I recall, was the general who was Meletius. He was able first to defeat the Persian forces at Marathon and then run quickly down to oppose them. This is at the end, it was a Salamis. Says to oppose them when they tried to land again. And because of that, at least for 10 years, Greece knew peace. Eventually, his son, according to the normally accepted model of history, his son Xerxes, again attempted to, with enormous force, to defeat the Greeks, and eventually he too was defeated. Historians, though, toy with the notion if a Meletius had not come up amongst the Athenian ranks, there won't be a person who actually thought of this bold strategy to overwhelm this superior force. If he hadn't been there, the Persians would have captured Athens. As we know, was the great center of Greek philosophy, and philosophy would never have come up. This is according to the standard historical model. Athens would have fallen. That would be basically the end of Greek philosophy. Western thought would have been altered. All of history would have changed. At least this is suggested. One man changed the whole course of history. What happens if Alexander the Great, while he was fighting Darius III, had fallen in battle, which he came very close to have been killed in battle? He would have never conquered the Persian Empire. The whole Hellenistic Empire, which influenced all thought, would never have come to be. How would history have been rewritten? One man, Alexander. Napoleon was defeated at Waterloo. What happens if he wouldn't be defeated? What happens if there wouldn't be the Duke of Wellington, a person of that, to lead the forces, the Allied forces against Napoleon? Maybe we'd be speaking French in this base medrash today. Quite possible. The one who was the greatest proponent of that school was a Scottish historian, essayist, named Thomas Carlyle. And according to him, it's great men that change history, not these predictable forces, but it's really great, which are totally unpredictable. The Torah's view of history, in a certain sense, is very close to Carlyle's. In this sense, of course, God, the Creator, not only created the world, controls the world, guides the world, and controls the flow of events. But great leaders who will make those changes are nurtured and cultivated in every generation. Even in the non-Jewish world, the prophets speak, even before Isaiah speaks about Koresh, Mashiach, this Cyrus, my anointed one. This is before Cyrus was even born. Josephus tells over the story that when Cyrus, the Persian conqueror of Babylon, visited the Jewish community. The community's leaders showed him the book of Isaiah prophesying his appearance. In terms of positive Jewish leaders, In every generation, the sense, the potential great person is before his birth is prepared to be the great man to lead the generation. The beginning of the prophecy of Jeremiah, Sefer Yirmiyahu, says Mibetan Yedaticha, says from the womb I knew you, I prepared you to be the great prophet Jeremiah. You were, in a sense, is we see a person of great promise is nurtured and trained and brought up for that position. God nurtures, Hashem nurtures these people. And I'd just like to a prime example of great men at crucial times is the subject of tonight's lecture, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. A person who changed the course of Jewish history. Our whole study of Talmud is based really as a running commentary on the Mishnah. The Mishnah, a accepted, uniform, concise outline of the whole oral law, has become the syllabus for Jews for almost 2,000 years of study. It's united Jews. They have a common syllabus. They have a common framework to decide Jewish law. Despite all our dispersions, it enabled the Torah not to be forgotten because there was a clear syllabus that was memorized by heart. So wherever Jews were, most far-flung areas, there was something there that they were trained from their early youth to memorize, and they always had this compendium of the oral law with them. According to many commentators, and this is something we'll discuss in the next lecture, the Mishnah was put into writing at this juncture. So not only did they have something to memorize by rote, it was really something to take with them. Wherever Jews went, they had something to take with them. So not only did we have the Tanakh, the Bible, but we have also the outline, at least, of Jewish practice, of Jewish law. And probably no one man, as normal as we could point to our spiritual survival, no man gets greater credit than Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, as called the editor of the Mishnah. In the first paragraph here in your notes, the Talmud commenting on the scripture says, "Vezorach Hashemesh, Avoh Hashemesh." This is something we've touched on previous lectures. Is the sun shines, the sun sets. The use of the repetition of the word sun, Vezorach Hashemesh, Avoh Hashemesh, is an allusion of two suns. One sun rises before the next sun sets. The sun of the new generation rises before the sun of the next generation sets. Shmuel Hanavi, Samuel the prophet, was nurtured by Eli, the great leader of the previous generation. By the time that Eli died, Shmuel, who was already 39, who had studied by his feet, was ready to take over the reins of the new generation. Leadership is prepared by God. So here we have the idea of God's role in human history, but we have the idea of the great man, Carlyle's view as well. And it starts off when Rabbi Akiva says, "Kishemes Rabbi Akiva noilad Rabbi." When Yehuda died, Rabbi was born. And it seems, according to the Rambam, and this is, of course, historian Revisa Kalevi, and this is a point we're going to bring further, the idea is when Rebbe died, so when Rabbi Akiva died, Rabbi, and this is the the honorific name given to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and is the rabbi, rabbi is a rabbi par excellence, teacher par excellence. He was already born. He was ready to take over. It wasn't like Shmuel and Eli, the mantle wasn't immediately given to him, but he was there. The process of growth had already begun. And it goes on to describe this continuity of leadership until Rav Ashi, the editor of the Talmud. And it's really just a few generations here. When Rabbi died, Rabbi Yehuda was already born. And these are subjects we're going to discuss as we go on in this series. When Rav Yehuda died, Rava was born. When Rava died, Rav Ashi was born. There was a continuity of Jewish leadership. In the second paragraph, we quote the Gemara Megillah in Yud Aleph Amud Aleph in 11a, which describes again the various difficult times we've experienced in our history under the domination of foreign governments. And despite the vicissitudes, says Hashem has not rejected us. He has produced great leaders. And again, the focus on leadership. And it goes down, it says, you can read this yourself, but in the time of the Romans, it describes Rabbi, remember Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, and the sages of the various generations. Rabbi is the first among equals, the one in Roman times, in the most difficult times, to have provided this leadership that guaranteed our survival. He was a person who was prepared for this role in a very special way. Generally, the great leaders were blessed with great saintliness, great wisdom, but not necessarily with great personal wealth. So their political influence was limited. Here we have on page 2, top of page 2, Omer Rabba Berei de Rava, Rabba the son of Rava, Vitamer of Hillel Berei de Ravolos, Ruhil, the son of Rabbi Valas, also said, between Moses and Rabbi, this is some 1,500 years, we do not find one who was supreme both in Torah and in worldly affairs. It's a unique ability where he was, this is Torah Gedula B'Mokam Echot. He was the greatest Torah authority and the most powerful political person. It was combined in Moses, it was combined in Rabbi. The Gemara continues on, it's interesting, and again this is a subject we're going to next year, that there was the next time this occurred was in the lifetime of Rav Ashi, who was the editor of the Talmud. Again, it was important for in certain critical junctures of history that the person who is going to make his mark be a person who not only is a man of tremendous integrity, but who carries tremendous respect and power as well. If a person has a dream and he sees Rabbi in that dream, or someone who says, it's a good sign, you can hope for wisdom. He was the embodiment of wisdom. And probably the greatest compliment was put to him. So in paragraph E on page 2, Rishim ben Yehuda said the name Rishim, this is ben Yehoi. He says, there are certain qualities that are proper, that a saint has. Noi, comeliness, in other words, a person that's physically is pleasing to the eye, is a person of greater influence. In fact, I was just reading in the Wall Street Journal, they made a study of people who are successful, you know, in the workplace, people that are at least perceived by their peers as having a comely appearance are more successful. So it's an advantage as a saint to influence his generation to have that quality. Strength, physical strength, riches, honor, wisdom. Zikna v'hasev is old age and hoary age. In other words, zikna is 60, seva is 70. Now, as a person reaches, there is a influence that carries with because of age. It's an elder statesman. He carries with him not only his knowledge, but the memories of a past generation that he could carry on with him. And children, that there is, after he is gone, he has those who've been brought up in his home, who've seen every move of his, know intimately his values, could carry on afterwards. And it goes on to continue this Mishnah. Rav Shimon ben Manasseh said, this is in the next Mishnah, these seven qualities were realized in Rabbi. Rav Yehuda HaNasi had these seven special qualities. As we stated before, the paths of Rav Yehuda HaNasi, Yehuda, the patriarch, prince, and Antoninus, the Roman emperor, their paths crossed early on. And I'd like to read with you on page 3. Beautiful story here. In paragraph A, on top of the page. We are taught in a medrash. This is the Medrash says, milk has the power to make impure, milk has the power to purify. When Rabbi was born, the Romans made a decree that is forbidden to perform circumcision. And this just very well fits in with we've passed the timeline really the past four classes. This time we did not pass the special timeline. But just to give you just a sense of the timing over here, which we're going to touch upon. Hadrian began his anti-Jewish decrees in the year 121. Part of his decrees was to outlaw circumcision. Marcus Aurelius Antoninus was born in the year 121. So the timing comes out very well. Rabbi's parents, this is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, the subject of the last lecture, had him circumcised. They found out about this. Because of his position, they didn't have him summarily executed. But rather, Caesar sent for Rabbi and his mother, they wanted to see the child, to be brought before him. His mother exchanged him for Antoninus. And as Antoninus' parents were of nobility, somehow there was a switch of the kids, and nursed him until she brought him before Caesar, who found him uncircumcised. He let them leave in peace. The governor who had accused them said, I myself saw they performed the circumcision on that child. I was there. However, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy Blessed, be constantly performs miracles for them. There's a quote from Ben Gurion. It says that what is for others miracles is for us day-to-day occurrence. They eventually repealed the decree. That was many years later. The Medrash seems to say, though, the fact is that Antoninus sucked the milk from Rebbe's mother's breasts had a profound influence on him. And that's what it says, Cholov Metahir. That he turned out to be such an unusual person, so atypical of the standard Roman, has to do with the fact is that he was breastfed on his mother's. Anyone who's a member of La Leche says, take heed. It seems from the passage in the Talmud, from the Drushim, that it was not similar to all of Jewish history. It was not just a chance occurrence that there happened to be two great people who came together in history. This is Marcus Aurelius and Rabi. But it was foretold or hinted at thousands of years before. And here in paragraph B on page 3, two nations are in thy womb. This was the prophecy told to Rivka, Rebecca, as she was having problems in her pregnancy. And he's saying that there's two nations that are warring against each other within you. The word goyim, which is normally spelled nations, gimel, vov, yud, mem, is spelled here geyim, with two yuds. This would be a proof to the Litvish or the Lithuanian pronunciation. It's all the same thing. Geyim and geyim, salts the cell. But the fact is that it was spelled with two yuds is indicative of a secondary meaning. Of course, a simple meaning is nations, but because that's the pronunciation. However, there's a secondary meaning of aristocracy. It says, "Read not begayim lords," and this is a ze Antoninus Verabi. In other words, these two children that are coming out, these two twins, are representative of another set of twins that will come in history. Two children of the same age, two infants of the same age. And again, it just describes their table. Leposkom al shulchanon, there was neither, they had lettuce, radish, cucumber, which these was all, this is not the main, these aren't people who aren't Weight Watchers. this was a means to really, as an appetite enhancer. It was a way of saying that you're going to have a great meal. They're going to give you things to increase your appetite, so because there's more to come. But at least the Medrash, the Gemara, looks at it that really these two people and their relationship was really prophesied way before it actually occurred. Just to give you a sense of the wealth. We know we have a sense of the wealth, of course, of the Roman emperors. But to give you a sense of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's wealth, this is quoting the Gemara in paragraph C on page 3. Rabbi's house steward, in other words, the one who just took care of his, you know, yes master, was wealthier than the Persian king. Well, I would like to see his Swiss bank account. Okay. I would like now, just to give you a sense, just to summarize, we discussed the idea originally of the relationship of the patriarchs, and their story influenced future events. Yaakov and Esau's relationship influenced the events of their descendants, the Jews and the Romans, which according to Jewish tradition, the Romans are partially descendant from Esau, from Yaakov's twin brother. We've discussed the idea of great men influencing history, and these great men are brought out by God himself. Rebbe's on one side, Antoninus, the Roman Emperor, on the other side. I'd like to discuss now some of the similarities, amazing similarities, in their personalities. And of course, the Medrash we quoted before maintains the similarities come to no small measure. The fact is that Antoninus suckled at the breast of Rebbe's mother. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is called, had another name, title to him, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, the Holy Rabbi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi lived in a time of great saints. To give the title Holy Rabbi, one must have been very, very unusual. And turn to page 4. Rabbi Yossi was one of the greats of the previous generation. I've never looked at my circumcised member. He never looked at it. He didn't want to be reminded of it. He was afraid that he would be stimulated, perhaps. And he never looked at it. This was his chassidus. This was his... This was beyond what is called for in Jewish law, but this was his siyog, this was his fence that he made. So the Talmud asked the question. Evidently, it seems to be behavior that great people did. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was once asked, why are you called Rabbeinu HaKodesh, our holy teacher? How did you get that name? What did you do to deserve this? And he offered the explanation is because I never looked at my circumcision. And evidently, if that would be the case, Rabbi Yossi should also be called that with that title. So the Rebbe had something even greater. He didn't put his hand beneath his girdle. In other words, his hand never went below his belt, just in case it could come out that he would ever touch his milah. And he was very, very careful. And that care and that concern earned him the title of the Holy Rabbi. Besides this sense of sanctity, we quote here in the next paragraph here, page 4. It says, Mishmeis Rabbi Botel Anova V'Yerushchei. When Rebbe died, humility and the fear of sin ceased. In other words, he was the embodiment of this humility and fear of sin. After he died, there was no one who was even in the same league, same category of his. When he died, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi lifted up his 10 fingers. Here's in paragraph D. He says, Sovereign of the universe, it is revealed and known to you that I have labored in the study of Torah with my 10 fingers, and I did not enjoy any worldly benefits, even with my little finger. Because he had no... in other words, he never enjoyed the world for enjoyment's sake. If you eat, you enjoy. But the eating was part of becoming healthier, of enjoying Shabbos or Yontif. He never went just to go out to eat. I hate to undercut Mrs. Rabinowitz's business with this. But this was his Kedusha. This was the Kedusha of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. That's made him so special. I'd like to now describe Antoninus, Marcus Aurelius, from someone who was a contemporary of his. Lived a little afterwards, but basically contemporary. This is Dio Cassius, the great Roman historian. Now let's read this together. It's just amazing. It's so atypical of what you would expect from a Roman. Marcus Antoninus, the philosopher, upon obtaining the sovereignty at the death of Antoninus Pius, his successor, and he was a son-in-law, by the way, of Antoninus Pius, who adopted him, had immediately taken to share the authority with him, the son of Lucius Commodus, Lucius Verus. He was personally, immediately he gave over some of his power. He was personally weak in body and devoted the greater part of his time to letters. He is told that even when he was emperor, he showed no shame or hesitation in going to a teacher for instruction, but became a pupil of Sextus, of Chironi, a grandson of Plutarch, the Boeotian philosopher. Boeotia is in northeast Greece. It's where Thebes, the city of Thebes was. And did not hesitate to go and to hear the lectures of Hieronymus on a rhetoric. He was most inclined to the Stoic school. was this, the Stoic school is described in Josephus the closest to the Pharisees. Those of moderation, of introspection. The emperor, this is from Book 71, Chapter 1. In Book 72, Chapter 6, this is describing how he conducted his court. In other words, where judicial, where he acted as a judge in court. The emperor, as often as he had leisure from war, held court and used to order a most liberal supply of water in the clepsydra, or water clock, be measured for the speakers. In other words, he gave the speakers all the time to articulate their views instead of cutting them short. Because he wanted to make sure that they're defending somebody. In other words, this is a court of law, and they have enough time to plead their case. He made inquiries and answers of greater length so that exact justice was ensured by every possible expedient. He was industrious and applied himself diligently to all the duties of his office. He took very little food always, and that at night. The comparison would be Yehuda Hanasi, who didn't have the pleasure, never had pleasure from this world. This is Book 72, Chapter 6. After all, we read further, he owed his greatest attainments chiefly to his natural disposition, for even before he enjoyed the society of those men, he was unflinchingly set upon virtue. While still a boy, he delighted all his relations, who were numerous, influential, and wealthy, and was loved by all of them. This most of all led Hadrian to adopt him into his family, and Marcus, for his part, did not grow haughty, but though young and a Caesar, he dutifully played the part of a servant to Antoninus Pius through all the latter's reign, and ungrudgingly did honor to the other men of eminence. He visited many who were sick, and invariably met his teachers at the proper time. He was always steeped in Greek and Latin, rhetorical and philosophical learning, though he reached the man's estate and had hopes of becoming emperor. This is taken from chapter 35 of Book 72. In chapter 29, an amazing story. This is how he describes this. There happened to be a plot against him. There was a conspiracy against him. It was led by a certain Cassius, who was the governor of Syria. Moreover, he says, Marcus destroyed the documents relating to this plot, not reading them, in order that he may not learn even a name of any of the conspirators who had written something against him, that he might not therefore be reluctantly forced to hate anyone. Marcus was so averse to slaughter that he saw to it that the gladiators in Rome contended without danger, like athletes, for he never permitted any of them to have any sharp iron, but they fought with blunt weapons rounded off at the ends. The description of this person is really, as you'd say, you think he's Jewish, not Roman. It's very, very atypical of a Roman. This is the description of Marcus Aurelius. As far as I know, from all my readings, there is no one amongst any of the anyone described in Roman history, either by Diocasius or Tacitus, that compares with this person. According to the Medrash, it's because he nursed at Rebbe's mother's breast. But the similarity between them is also phenomenal. Now, just again, like just to briefly touch upon, again, some of the similarities. We find in page 5, just briefly go through this. Rabbi went far and wide. Not only did he study under his father, but he went to study by the greats of his generation. He went to Rabbi Shimon. He was a student of Rabbi Talmud, a disciple of Rabbi Shimon. He was a disciple of Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua. These were Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Elazar were disciples of Rabbi Akiva. He was on page 6 in paragraph C. We find him studying under his father, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha. According to Rashi, Rashi's explanation in the Gemara in Erevin, this is in paragraph D, he studied by Rabbi Meir, the most brilliant of his generation, a subject to one of our previous lectures, and he sat in the rows behind him. In other words, he was young then. Even though he came from a royal family, so to speak, he was son of Rashi Gamliel, a grandson of Rabbi Gamliel. But he sat in the back, behind the speaker. And he says, "That which I am keener than my colleagues, I saw the back of Rabbi Meir. If I would have seen him from the front," this is how Rashi understands this, if I would have had a good look, because I would have a better position, I would even be keener. He studied under Rabbi Yehuda, the subject of a previous lecture, another disciple of Rabbi Akiva's. His main teacher, though, and this is on page 7, and this is a thing from Yerushalmi, the 10th chapter in Pesachim, Arbe Pesachim, was Rabbi Yaakov ben Kurshaya, who is known just as Rabbi Yaakov. And again, we find him with his love of learning. I'm just describing an incident that while this is Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon, these are the great disciples of Rabbi Akiva, while they were walking on the road, I went and asked them a question. And it describes a question. So here's a person who studied under the great students of Rabbi Akiva, studied under his father, studied under Rabbi Yaakov. And here we have the correspondent, in other words, the parallel again in Antoninus, who, as we've described before, and we'll just read this again, it is told, this is from the Dio Cassius, that even when he, Marcus Antoninus, was emperor, he showed no shame or hesitation going to a teacher for instruction. We've described before, the fact is, his studies on rhetoric. It seems that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi himself also had this sense of linguistic purity. There's a statement here on the bottom of page 7. Rabbi stated, "Why use the Syriac language in Eretz Yisrael?" Lashon Sursi, which is an Aramaic language. Why don't they use either Lashon HaKodesh, that's Hebrew, the holy tongue, or the Greek language, which was the universal language, which has a certain beauty to it as well? What do they have to use? Basically, it was the colloquial language of the time. We find a poetry that was used in the house of Rebbe on page 8, which is often quoted in the Talmud. This is Rebbe's maidservant, and describes, again, you can just look at it yourself, her linguistic skills and her poetry. And the commentaries attribute this, the fact is, because she was the maid of Rabbi's house. He had this sense. And again, as we've quoted this before, again, the parallel to Antoninus, he was steeped, as he says, in rhetoric. He went to the lectures of Aragonus on rhetoric. He was steeped in Greek and Latin rhetorical and philosophical learning. And also, it seems fascinating, again, the parallel between these two people. Just by the way, just as an off, just to give you an understanding here, very often when you come in contact with Latin names, we have generally three names, like Marcus Aurelius Antoninus. What are the three names? At least originally, and there may have been changes at later times, but originally, the three names represented three distinct names that people had. Marcus was known as a praenomen. That's his name. You know, the name that they give them at the bris. You know what I mean? Yikarei Shmoi B'Yisrael. The name is, that's his proper name. That's called a praenomen. Nomen, the middle one, is the name of the general family that he comes from. This would be a large, like a tribal name. You know, it's a very large family. So Aurelius was, let's say, a very large family, like Cayenne, Levi, you know, it's a very large Roman family. In the Roman families, Elijah had, would be subfamilies. That was the cognomen. Originally, it was a subfamily. Very often, when a person was adopted, remember, he took his cognomen, his last name, from the adoptive family. Marcus Aurelius was adopted by Antoninus Pius, the previous emperor. And he took his cognomen, the third nomen, Antoninus. So that's why he was Marcus, which was his praenomen, his real name, Aurelius, and then Antoninus, the cognomen. So that's why he'd be often called Aurelius or Marcus or Antoninus. But that's really, those are the three basic names. So first is the praenomen is the proper name. The nomen, which is the large family name. And the cognomen, which is either generally a subfamily name or what's given to the person as he's adopted. It's a special name. Eventually, these great people met. And here on page 9, we describe the meeting between them. And I'm just going to briefly go through this. There was a rebellion in Syria led by Cassius, who was the governor. He came, he brought his son Commodus. And as they were ready to make preparations, Cassius himself was killed in the interim. He was assassinated. But as he came to the people involved, you know, to the rebellious troops, he treated them very kindly, and no one was obscure or prominent was put to death. Again, it's very Jewish. It's very non-Roman, his whole conduct. It would seem, historians claim, it seems that it's during this juncture, when he was in Syria, after Syria, in the Judea's part of Syria, that he came to Eretz Yisrael, he came to Palestine. It was in all probability here that he met Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And it describes the Talmud, the Gemara in Avodah Zorah, in Yudam and Beis, in 10b, describes their meeting. Romans, by and large, had a great hatred towards the Jews. And this is something we've discussed in previous lectures. Antoninus, of course, was an exception. But he did not want to make his pro-Jewish feelings to be made known. And we could understand here on paragraph B in page 9, Antoninus had a cave which led from his house to the house of Rabbi. Every time he visited Rabbi, this Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, he brought two slaves. So he would go through this underground passageway to Rabbi's house. And he'd bring with him two slaves. One of whom he slew at the door of Rabbi's house. He didn't want people to know. And one, the other, when he came back home, he killed at his own house. He could lose more men that way. Tysus is bothered, you know, by the thing. How could he, a person like do such a thing? And he claimed that these were people that basically would be put to death. I mean, at least one of his answers is that he needs to put to death in any case. So he just used this as, you know, and of course is that since the natural course of things is people speak and don't keep secrets, it's quite like his life would be endangered if he had not killed them. But in any case, Tosfos really grapples and only theorizes, meaning the absence of knowledge, must be these are people that would have been, you know, there'd be grounds to put to death in any case. And he used this occasion. And again, these are things I think you should take home with you and, you know, read them. The time doesn't go through. Just fascinating stories. But one interesting incident, which again, which fits in with the general historical background here, is the following section here on page 10. Here the Gemara describes the fact that normally Romans, in the Roman government, this had been for quite a few years already, normally their children did not succeed them. The last ones who had been a succession, really, since the beginning of the empire until this date, the only emperors that had a true succession of children that succeeded them were Vespasian, whose children first Titus, and then Domitian succeeded Vespasian. Domitian was a son of Vespasian. After Domitian's death, there was no more true successions of children. There were adopted children, not true biological children. Adoption, by the way, was not as we normally understand adoption here. Adoption, as we understand, is you're adopting a child, you're going to take care of the child, and it becomes part of your family legally. A person, even an own child, once they reach adulthood, they're independent. In the Roman idea, there's no such a thing as independence. A child, he could be 85, and his parents could be who knows how old, is still under his parents' domination in the Roman system. They probably did not really exercise this illegal option that they had, but really parenthood really went far beyond the age that you're allowed to drive or drink. The idea of being in a family carried with it a religious overtone, a mystical overtone. There were family gods, and those gods had to be served by the family. They interceded on behalf of the family. An adopted son from another family who had another set of gods would join this new family and would have now this new set of patron gods. So the adoption had to be approved by the priesthood. And one really, it was significant that one left his own family and became the adopted son of the new family. And the priesthood only gave permission for this adoption process if there would be something left of the old families that the gods would be tended to. And there was this mutual relationship that the gods needed to be taken care of as well, so to speak. Like they don't make gods like they used to, you know. Yeah, so the gods needed to be taken care of. So you had this thing that the adoption really took a person away from the domain of those gods, the old familiar gods, you know, and brought him into a new set of gods. So it was a real official religious practice, adoption. So you say he was adopted, there were older people that were adopted. There were adults that were adopted. But in true biological children, there had been from the time that rare occasion you have from Vespasian to Titus and then to Domitian, there had been no succession. And the Talmud deals with the fact that one could celebrate a king's birthday. The day that the king, the king's birthday and the successor's birthday. In other words, the appointed successor that would be his sons. So you have the son is, the king has appointed his son as successor, and the Romans are celebrating two official birthdays. The old king and the appointed new king. And now this appointed new king is really a co-monarch. With the old king. And it describes that this is really not a Roman practice. And it says, yes, but it did occur once. You have the idea of the father's birthday, the son's birthday, the father's day of that he came to the throne, right? and the day that his son came to the throne. I mean, you'd have really 4 days. You know, it says in the Roman calendars there are a lot of days off. Rome was a big union town. They had, it was a most of the, it was through the calendar, this is the most of the, a good part, it was going to, a good part of the year went away in holidays. You know, they wonder why the Roman Empire fell, you know what I mean? It describes, though, that there was one exception here, that we found the succession took place in the lifetime, you know, of the king, that his son became his successor in his lifetime. And that happened with Antoninus and his son Asverus. And this took place through the advice of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. This is how it's described in the Talmud. We know that Antoninus had a son that succeeded him by name of Commodus. According to the Talmud, then, Commodus had a different name as well. There are many names people had, and one was Asverus, or Verus. We know that when Antoninus took the throne, as Marcus took the throne, he had a co-ruler whose original name was Verus, Lucius Verus, and he added the name Commodus to him. He named his son, Antoninus now named his son after, says he named him Commodus after the other one. It could very well be he also had the name Verus. On page 11 here, we find returning in the year 176, he took Commodus to the front and proclaimed him joint emperor with himself. Two opposing principles had hitherto governed the succession. The senatorial aristocracy wished the emperor, in consultation with the elder statesmen, to choose the best man among themselves as his successor. And throughout the Talmud, Rebbe is constantly dealing with problems with the Senate, with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. What to do with them? He has many enemies in the Senate. His advice was divide and conquer. Pick each one off one by one. The army and the bulk of the provincials, apprehensive of the risk of civil war that attended a doubtful succession, preferred a hereditary succession. The conflict of ideas has been masked for 3 generations, since none of the 4 previous emperors had been survived by a son. This thing by the Encyclopedia Britannica. And here we find this idea, these dynamics really were the things that governed the succession. But he was successful, Antoninus, in having his son be named his successor. It is worthwhile, and time doesn't allow for me to go through all of these things. Take this home with you. His advice, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's advice, how to deal with enemies, if you could use it for yourself. Deal with family troubles. One very interesting thing is the way that Antoninus, the respect that he afforded Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. On page 12, paragraph A, every time he came to visit him during that period of time while he was in Palestine, he used to attend on Rebbe and wait on him with food or drink. He had such tremendous awe of him. Again, we're looking at this Marcus Aurelius, a person who always went, and just we look at his profile, who went to teachers, was not ashamed. And here he was overawed by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi and served him as a small disciple would serve a master. When Rabbi wanted to go on to his bed, and the bed was used to, the beds that they had was not just to sleep, was to eat as well. It's like a couch. Antoninus crouched in front of it, saying, "Go on to your bed by stepping on me." As the beds were very often high and they needed a stepping stool, he says, "Let me be the stepping stool." He said, "How could I do it? You're a king." So he says, "Halavai, I should serve you as a mattress in the world to come." There's a sense of how he felt. And he also gave him equivalent much of the additional wealth the Rabbi Yehuda Anasi had was from gifts from Antoninus. On paragraph B, we find he sent him a gold dust in a leather bag filled with wheat at the top. In other words, again, his relationship with him was clandestine. In other words, he did not want the Romans, who hated the Jews, to know that he had such a strong relationship with Yehuda Anasi, because he was very fearful of the powerful people, the Senate, the noblemen in Rome. But he sent him wheat. There was a thing of wheat, and below the wheat was gold dust. And Rebbe said, I don't need the money. He says, yeah, but it'll be good enough. He says, after I leave this world, there are going to be Roman emperors who normally are going to demand great taxes from you. I'm preparing you. You'll have the wherewithal to be able to survive. You know, this is Roman government, and this is really the this is the relationship they had. Again, this on I like just to skip 13 and 14. You should read on your own. Fascinating, the philosophical conversations between Antoninus and Rabbi. One very interesting thing is, now it's Masoi Shabbos. This is on page 14, in paragraph B. Rabbeinu, our master, Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, Rabbi Yehuda the patriarch, made a meal for Antoninus on Shabbos. And he brought him cold dishes. What's he brought him? He ate from them and was pleased. At another time, he came in the middle of the week for a meal, and he made hot dishes for Antoninus. He says, you know what? What I had on Shabbos was better. So he says, you know, how come these aren't good enough? So Rebbe told him, they're missing a spice. So they're missing a spice. We'll get you any spice from the spice sellers. What are you missing? It's missing Shabbos. The food on Shabbos has special taste. This is in the Medrash Rabbah. This is in Yud Aleph Dala. This has to do with Shabbos. There's one version Antoninus converted to Judaism. And it also fits in well with the idea of what we said before. According to this version, he circumcised himself and wanted to show Rabbi that he was circumcised. This is on page 15. On the first paragraph, at the end of the first paragraph, says, Rabbi, see my circumcision. He replied, I never looked at my own circumcision. This we have the great for. How could I look at yours? But according to this version, actually, he actually did convert. Marcus Aurelius, on the bottom page 15, was born in April of 121 of the Common Era and died in March, in the year 180. He was succeeded by his son Commodus. This would be according to Talmud Asavirus, who ruled until his assassination on December 31st, 192. To give you a sense of the dating of how long Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi lived, we said before that they were switched as children. So if Marcus Aurelius was born in the year 121, some Rabbi Yehuda Anasi was born in the year 121. Also fits in the fact that the, you know, it occurred at the same time that Hadrian issued the prohibition against circumcision. On page 16, we have Antoninus the Lesser. Notice this is Commodus. Grandson Antoninus the Great. That's Antoninus Pius. As we said, Marcus Aurelius was the adopted son of Antoninus Pius. He was also the son-in-law. His son, Commodus, as we're saying, Antoninus the Lesser, was therefore a grandson of Antoninus the Great, Antoninus Pius. He once asked Rebbe, who's going to die first? And Rebbe prophesied that Rebbe Yehuda Hanossi is the one to die first. We know, this is a thing from the Medrash Helas Rabbah in chapter 10, this is paragraph 5. In the Yalkut Shemoni, the Medrash Yalkut Shemoni on Zechariah in chapter 11, we find that Rabbi Antoninus the Lesser would come out, and Karvon, that's what is described here, or Artavon, the king of Persia or Parthia, died in 1 month. And those three great political leaders died in 1 month: the leader of the Jews, the leader of the Romans, and the leader of the Parthians. Since Commodus died in December of the year 192, so Rebbe died shortly before that. It comes out if Marcus Aurelius Antoninus was born in March of 121, and that Rebbe Yehuda HaNossi therefore lived to be a little less than 72 years old, which also we know that he had Zikna, which is 60, and Seva, which is 70. So he lived to be a little less than 72. We reconstruct this. During his reign, during this period, because that Antoninus developed such strong friendship, and we see that there was this relationship continued on in Antoninus' son, as they say, Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi was able to do something that was unprecedented. And this is a Rashi in Bava Metzia, quotes in Lamed Gimel Amud Beis in 33b. It's based on the tshuva from the Gaonim, a responsa from the Gaonim, from Rishrira Gaon, that he was able to bring, without Roman persecution, bring all the greatest Jewish minds together to go through all of the oral law to produce the final Mishnah. The Mishnah that we have is the collective work of the greatest Jewish scholars of the time under the auspices of Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi, the son of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, the subject of the last lecture. Because of the grace given to them by the Romans, because of the close relationship that he had with Antoninus, they were able to produce the Mishnah. It just goes to show you what a little mother's milk can do. Next, in two weeks from now, the subject of the lecture is the creation of the Mishnah. We're going to go the whole history from the time of Moses, of Moshe Rabbeinu, till the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNossi, how the Mishnah developed and how it came to its final form. Okay, are there any questions? There's much Stoic influence, which is very similar. It's the origin of the Stoics to Jewish influence. I was not able in time of the class to get hold of the meditations and to make a comparison. My sense is though that probably there is very much Jewish influence there.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48236.